You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of November 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
I don't even know him. All of a sudden, you know, they make it like he's my best friend. I don't know.
Donald Trump puts a call in to Vladimir Putin and claims he's looking forward to a strong and enduring relationship with Russia. My guests today, Nina Schick and Robert Fox, will be examining which other countries might be left out in the cold by the duo's blossoming bromance. Also ahead...
We're not trying to replicate the deal that any other country has with the EU, and we're not going for an off-the-shelf solution.
As an embarrassing memo leak reveals Theresa May reportedly has no strategy for Brexit, we'll ask how long it'll take before the British public demands some real answers. We'll also be asking what's on Barack Obama's agenda as he arrives in Greece.
The ideas of ancient Greece helped inspire America's founding fathers as they reached for democracy. Our revolutionary ideas helped inspire Greeks as they sought their own freedom. And Americans came here to help fight for Greek independence.
And we'll find out what the world can learn from the can-do approach of the Japanese. That is all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome indeed to Midori House. My guests today are Robert Fox, defence editor for London's Evening Standard newspaper, and Nina Schick, independent political consultant. A warm welcome to you both. Great to have you with us on the programme. US President-elect Donald Trump, still takes a bit of getting used to, has had his first phone call with the opposite number in Moscow, Vladimir Putin. The call reportedly focused on improving the increasingly cool relationship between the two nations, with Trump saying he's very much looking forward to a strong and enduring relationship with Russia and the people of Russia. It's the first major pointer to Trump's future foreign policy initiatives, and it's already drawn comment from NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg briefing EU defence ministers in Brussels today. Stoltenberg welcomed the potential for increased dialogue, but repeated his view that Russia's annexation of Crimea has been an unacceptable breach of the sovereignty of Ukraine. Robert Fox, I'll start with you perhaps. Is Trump going to take any EU considerations or any NATO pronouncements for that matter on board?
No, because I think I'm against the bien pensant who said, just look what Trump stands for, don't take any notice of what he says. I do think you do have to look at some of the things that he said. And it's very clear what he was saying about NATO and Putin. If you really draw it in, he wants to engage to disengage. It is, I think, it is a substantial change, and it's been coming a long time. With in security commitments, the US is overstretched. Not that Trump would describe it in those terms, but why go and seek an enmity where he, Donald Trump, doesn't say that see that you need one? It's very interesting. It's quite vague, but he does want engagement because what he has learnt from intuitively is the style of Obama. Obama, cool, cerebral, detached. He is going to be engaged, be warm, to save a lot of grief. But he doesn't have a detailed agenda. Mr. Putin certainly does, starting from chaos in NATO right the way through Crimea, Ukraine, Syria, the Baltics, and getting the sanctions lifted. How many of those he will get before the roulette wheel spins again? I'm not sure.
Nina, we'll perhaps talk a little bit about what this means for certain countries in Eastern Europe who are particularly concerned, of course, about the rhetoric and where it might lead. But what about NATO? I mean, Robert makes a good point, doesn't it? This is a difficult time for the organisation. It was being questioned already. Jens Stoltenberg's made his pronouncements. What next for that institution? It's a tough question.
It's a really tough question because, of course, this has been the linchpin of American foreign policy since the end of the Second World War, and the Europeans are terrified. And I think that one thing that commentators and political analysts, perhaps a mistake that they're making, is they're assuming that Donald Trump is a rational actor. And these are all the same people that said he will temper himself once he wins the Republican nomination. He will temper himself once he gets into the White House. But while you can hope for the best, you also have to prepare for the worst. And of course, the EU has found themselves very, you know, they're at a loose end. They don't know what to do about this. And there is a lot of reason to criticize their involvement in NATO. I mean, none of the EU countries basically stand up to their military spending commitments. So it's no wonder that the Baltic countries and countries like Germany have no idea what Trump's ambivalent kind of statements at best mean for them going forward. And they're in a position where they don't know what they can do as a bloc either if NATO somehow falters. So it's a very tricky situation for them. And I think that the big winner is Putin. Of course, I think that with regards to the sanctions, it'll be very hard for the EU to continue renewing those sanctions on Russia without the US really leading strongly in that arena.
And of course, Robert, if we go back to Ukraine, if we look at things like the Crimea incursion, Stoltenberg said it's an unacceptable breach. Where does this leave Ukraine? Because it appears like the logical conclusion of this would be a rapprochement, maybe the end of sanctions. Is there any other option, as you see it, as regards the Ukraine in particular?
Messy compromise, and that seems to be on the way. And I think Trump has signaled that. Look, Jens Stoltenberg, I think Jens Stoltenberg and Juncker have misspoken in the aftermath of the Trump victory, because to say this, no, they're not going to get Crimea back, and to go banging on that drum, I think, okay, it's principled, but it's completely impractical. Similarly, for Juncker to say, we've got to get together and make the European army, does he really know what he's talking about? He's a banker, I'm sorry to be. It is very expensive to replicate, even regionally, the joint command, the joint planning centre that NATO has in Mons, in Belgium. It is very, very expensive indeed. And as you rightly say, including the UK, the European powers of NATO have not stepped up to the 2% of GDP real expenditure on hard power security items. The UK typically does it by throwing in pensions and bits of defence real estate and the intelligence services. No, I think that a lot of Americans, probably quite a few Democrats, would applaud Trump when he's saying, look, come on, Europeans. What do you really mean? It's not just sending a frigate down to the Mediterranean to rescue refugees or migrants. How are you going to deal with that? And further down the road, and we haven't heard Trump on this yet, is the colossal expense of renewing the nuclear arsenal that NATO has. It's crucifying the budget of France. It's going to do much the same with the UK, and it's a heck of a problem for the US, because, of course, it has nuclear weapons in three dimensions, land, sea and air. And I think that will cross the Trump presidency desk, too, and it's going to be very difficult.
Now, Robert makes the point then that we haven't heard from Trump on this or on many things yet, and people are understandably awaiting appointments he makes to his cabinet, of course, and we talked about trying to predict him or second-guess him. It's interesting looking at some of the potential Secretaries of State who've been mentioned. People have said, I don't know, a John Bolton, maybe quite a hawkish character. How would that fit with Trump's general narrative vis-a-vis Russia? Because one could imagine that saying that he and Bolton wouldn't see eye to eye on treatment of Putin is perhaps an understatement. It'll be certainly interesting to watch who gets that job.
Absolutely. And I think that's a key thing, a key indicator to watch out for as to what type of president he will be, given his temperament throughout the campaign. So I think the key question is he going to go with the traditional security, you know, establishment in Washington when it comes to the State Department, or is he going to go for loyalists? And that is something that, you know, the indication so far, given who he's appointed to his main policy advisor, again, he seems to foil expectations and go for the choice that is irrational. So I think this idea that somehow Trump is a rational player is perhaps one that the collective elite establishment, quote unquote.
Oh, that's them again. Yeah,
the metropolitan elite is telling themselves, because it's just such a shock that there has to be some kind of narrative to make sense of all of this. But I think that perhaps there isn't much sense to be made of this. It is just a very different era.
Robert, what do you make of that on the personnel side of things? Is it largely moot if you've got someone who is as unpredictable and is as consistently inconsistent as Trump has been throughout what you could loosely term his campaign?
Then he might find somebody like John Bolton as very attractive. I would say he is quite right-wing. No, leave the quite out of it. Very hawkish.
I was trying to be.
And remember, he didn't get confirmed, even at the end of the run under George W. as permanent representative. representative at the UN because he spent all his time bashing the UN. And even Congress got very, very worried about that. Bolton, I feel sure, will be somewhere in the hierarchy.
But what message was that sent, for example, to Moscow, if you have somebody who is as outspoken about his views about, you know, well, certainly about a putative alliance with Putin?
In a funny way, they love it. They'd prefer it to an Obama figure who is elusive. You know, now you see him, now you don't. He's a will of the wisp in some ways to the way Moscow's posture is currently. It's very heroic. It's very military. It is very. It is going back to the Russian Empire. It's Alexander III rather than Alexander II, not the reformist Tsar, but his very reactionary heir. Really, in the era of really looking at the good old boys, and they've been volunteering. James Woolsey, former head of the CIA, would like to be National Security Advisor, possibly Secretary of State. I don't think he's going to do that. But it's a thing that I've thought a lot since Trump's victory was announced, is what is his rapprochement going to be with the military establishment? I'm not going to say ooh la la, because there are many I know in the US military establishment who actually love him, who they, you know, now Stanley, great, this is the kind of stuff, you know, they found Obama impossible. I don't have to go back to the debacle of Stan McChrystal and Obama. But which of the generals is he going to pick? Because he's going to have to pick one of them, because it's an area which is an absolutely clean slate as far as he's concerned. Now, is it going to be an egghead like David Petraeus, or is it going to be, frankly, a kick-ass figure like Jack Keane? But I could see either one of those or both those coming into either the National Security Council apparatus, or either being a security advisor, or even being a deputy in the Pentagon, because I think the Secretary of State for Defense is going to be very, very interesting indeed, because he or she will have a lot to do.
The personnel questions are interesting, Nina. We haven't spoken since Trump won, and I'm still, I don't know, optimistically hoping that maybe by accident rather than by design, Trump may muddle through and get in a cabal of people who somehow emerge with, if not a coherent set of policies, something that's not quite as bad as the doomsday scenario we've been preparing for. Do I need to get my head examined?
If he does any, so if he carries through a few of the policies that he's been talking about during the referendum, during the election campaign, then I think, you know, they would be disastrous. We're talking about, in particular, when it comes to foreign policy, environmental policy. I mean, this is, of course, a hugely disturbing development when it comes to civil liberties domestically. I mean, and people keep saying that Trump lies, he flip-flops, you know, don't take him seriously. It was just a shtick. Once he assumes the office of president, he will, you know, he'll surround himself by advisors, he'll be on the golf course and we don't have to worry. But on some things, he's been as consistent as, you know, the Northern Star. For one, on economics, he's an economic nationalist. We know that his policies take us away from globalization, free trade, the very system that the economic global prosperity has been based upon. So I have no doubt that it does shift a big, big change. And I also think that aside from the environment, it's very, very destructive to civil liberties in the US. And I don't think there's any way to sugarcoat that.
Sorry, I think I'll take that as I do need to get my head examined. Yeah. Let's move on. It's not been a good day for the British PM, Theresa May. A leaked memo reported by the Times of London suggests that the upper reaches of government still have no clear strategy for Brexit. I don't know how surprised many people will be by that so-called revelation. The process could eventually require the employment of 30,000 extra civil servants. May's denied the memo from a consultancy firm has any influence on government strategy, but hasn't really provided any actual strategy herself since June 23rd. Nina, the UK government, Theresa May, have on this sort of poker face. How long can they keep that going for?
Well, I think the poker face is quickly slipping right now. And I think it's clear for everyone. I mean, number 10 gave like a hilarious set of press conferences today where they were denying the memo had anything to do with them. But they knew they were briefing against the person that leaked it. But the bigger point is that people realize that the government is really having trouble. And that's no surprise, given that the people voted for Brexit, but nobody knows what Brexit means. You're unraveling 40 years of close connections with the EU. How on earth are you supposed to, within the space of 6, 7, 8 months, try and prepare a comprehensive negotiating position vis-a-vis the rest of the EU, 27 EU member states, on how you're going to extricate yourself? But I think the top line is that May's government is pushing for hard Brexit, as in they want to leave the single market within the space of the two-year allotted negotiating period, then have some kind of transitional agreement in place, and then try to have a wide-reaching FTA with the EU. The problem is, of course, that the EU is also going to be quite preoccupied with own going-ons in the year to come. So it'll be interesting to see how much time they have for the Brits in the negotiations.
I imagine not very much. Something tells me that. 30,000 extra staff working on around 500 projects, Robert. One imagines that's going to be quite expensive. One also imagines it's going to last rather a long time. That's not going to sit that comfortably with all the Brexiteers who decried the waste, the bureaucracy of the EU in the first instance.
The Brexiteers imagine that either Nigel Farage or Theresa May get your head round this, Henry VIII. Henry VIII, when he broke with Rome, which was the equivalent thing, swept it away with one act, one statute, the Act of Supremacy. There were technical ones, you know, the restraint of appeals to Rome, you know, the cutting of papal taxes and so on. That was the good old 16th century. It don't happen like that. But because behind the 500 projects and the 30, that's like Snow White and the 70 million dwarves, isn't it, really, if we're allowed to use that expression these days, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of regulations which have accumulated over the past 40 years who refer to EU, previously EC, European Community Bodies, for regulation. So you've got to push all that, all those words through as to who the regulating authority is going to be for square carrots or not. That's a facetious example, but it is the equivalent of that. And that is why this is an absolute nightmare. And the problem is, when you go back to Henry VIII, and this is the principle with which Theresa May is grappling, and grappling not very well. Not long after that, he said, "In no court do we stand higher as the King of England, but in the High Court of Parliament." That is actually even more than 1688, the Glorious Revolution. That is the thread which goes to where it is. Whatever in her wildest dreams, or Nigel Farage in his wildest dreams, may want. No, the people as such, in the way that Robespierre might have tuned up the mob in the French Revolution, the people are not sovereign, technically, in England at least, probably not in Scotland either. And this is where they've got a problem. And this is what the legacy, the poison chalice of David Cameron, because it's either in or out, he said. But it was as clear as mud as to what the real powers of this thing is. I would like to say very quickly, I take Nina's point, this is going to run on, and next year it is going to be item 247 of priority on the list of the European Council, of the Commission, of the Parliament even, because the headwinds are building up, both economically and politically, that the Brits, saying they want to leave but not knowing how they want to leave, it will become almost an irrelevance.
Well, we need to pick up on exactly that point. What are the chances here? We've seen indecision, we're seeing early signs of chaos before any kind of actual Brexit or even Brexit plan has happened. We're also going to see a further lurch right, well, we fear that, at the polls, whether it's in Germany, the Netherlands, certainly France, where it seems the most active threat.
And anarchy in Italy.
And Italy indeed as well, after their referendum. Even by, I don't know, a next general election here in the UK, if it takes until 2020, what chance that we're still wrapped by exactly the same indecision, the same chaos, and no real move forwards in terms of a break, hard or soft, from Europe?
Well, I think that the European Commission is actually preparing groundwork as well for Brexit. And they're hardened their position based on the rhetoric here in the UK. And what the Commission is preparing is to have a draft Brexit deal in place by 2018. So this is this hard Brexit followed by a transitional agreement, then followed by an FTA. The only problem is that will be very expensive for the Brits. So they'll have to pay anything. The estimate is between 40 to 60 billion for that. Now, try communicating that with the domestic electorate here, who didn't like the fact not the fact, but the £350 million a week. And I think it becomes very, very difficult. And the problem is that this narrative, which seems to have seized both the UK and America post-Trump, is that there's this narrative that this was somehow a huge democratic uprising of the people revolting against the establishment. And whilst, yes, it's true, it was a huge political shift, it's in both cases very, very divided countries. You know, it's like almost 50-50 down the line. So I think that nonetheless, politicians seem to have bought into this. So they are fearful of doing anything that can be perceived as going against the will of the people. And that's going to be a tricky one.
Robert, perhaps just finally on this, it sort of, I almost find it tedious that I constantly ask this question. Where was this case being articulated by the Remainers at the time? Now, I know it was in part, but the sheer complexity of the situation, I don't remember people articulating that well. Was I looking in the wrong places? Were people were people closing their ears to the reality?
It looks as if both the Remainers and the Hillary supporters were out of the same playbook, which was adopted allegedly by a colleague of mine when he edited a new magazine for the Daily Telegraph. But he said, somebody said it wasn't particularly spectacular. He said, "I've dared to be dull because that's the truth. They dared to be dull, and it doesn't go over because what the outers and the Trump supporters, they've been sold a dream, but it's a dream that doesn't exist. It's a fantasy. It is actually very like what happened just over a century ago with very late romanticism. You could go back to a completely artificial and non-existent version of the past, or you smashed up everything at the present to go to a more dynamic and vibrant future. And that led to the war to end all wars in Europe. The romantics were behind that, the futurists and so on. I'm not predicting the same there, but what I'm looking at for both May and Farage, and they are united in this enterprise together, whether they like it or not, and for Trump, what happens when the disappointment kicks in? And I think it will happen. I don't think it's going to happen immediately. I agree with Nina. I think they'll have a fair win for about a year, 18 months. But what happens when the steel doesn't come back to Bethlehem, when you can't actually get coal out of the Appalachians out in and from the Kentucky mines at reasonable rates, and do you really want it? That's where the trouble comes in. And also when the realization comes, the reason why jobs have been lost is not just the Weasley Chinese dumping steel, but it's an awful world called automation. The robots are pushing us out of our jobs.
You're with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, Robert Fox and Nina Schick. Stay with us. Coming up next, Obama's in Europe. Is it because he'd rather be anywhere except the US right now?
Visit our online shop where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with the brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we'll take care of you personally. See you around!
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, Robert Fox and Nina Schick. Now, yesterday we discussed Barack Obama's planned visit to Europe. Today he's been in front of the cameras with Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras. Though tough questions about Greece's financial future are on the cards, the two, of course, also spoke about Obama's successor. Both observed that in order to do business on the world stage, Trump would have to tone down some of his more aggressive rhetoric. Nina Schick, what's Obama trying to achieve during this visit? Because he will have known, as it was all scheduled, that, you know, we would know who his successor would be. Is it a farewell tour? Do you think he thinks there's some proper work that can be done? Does he just help steal Europe for what's coming next? What do you think his main objectives are?
Well, I think, of course, it was a farewell tour. And given the unexpected result next week, I think he'll be doing his best to reassure European leaders that this does not mean the end of, you know, their close working relationship. And it's very interesting when you look at the different reactions to Trump's election here in the UK vis-a-vis the rest of the continent. And I think one one of the players that's most concerned, of course, is Angela Merkel, because now she's surrounded by strong men and she's undoubtedly the strongest leader in Europe and probably one of the only European leaders left who is in the center right. And I think she will survive her election next year as well. So that puts her in a position where she's already been heralded as, you know, the last bastion of liberal values in society. And I think that given German history and given how Germans felt about Trump, this actually entrenches her more. Of course, there will be opposition from the far right. She will lose votes. But she will be seen as even more, you know, Germany will become even more of a reluctant hegemon or a leader in Europe to try and present a counter narrative to what we see sweeping the US and the UK.
Robert, it's interesting talking about Frau Merkel. Obama described her as likely his closest international partner these 8 years, which may not be that surprising, I suppose, given, as you said, his occasionally slightly colder aspect towards world leaders. Where does the relationship between the US and Germany go now, do you think?
I think it's going to be very important, and I'm fascinated by Nina's diagnosis, because I do think that the presence of Trump is very, very important, and it will probably take some of the sting out of the opposition to Merkel from her own normal faithful over migration, because she is the best thing in town. For Obama, that is absolutely, it's a no-brainer that he would like dealing with her, because she is a grown-up, which Hollande hasn't been at times. Mm. At least of all, was David Cameron, and he should be. And Cameron just became a darn nuisance. But I do think that there's a very peculiar irony in what Obama has said today. Obama has praised the Greeks as the cradle of civilization, the mother of democracy, and he is standing next to a man who had to swallow the pill of austerity handed down by the Troika, though 61% of his electorate vote against it. I mean, really, the irony gene had passed Obama by this afternoon, I think, when he was saying that. And I don't think America gets, nor should they, because the relationship with Europe is so freighted, is what trouble Europe is in. And this is where Merkel will be tested. And she is the only one that seems to be on the case. The terrible condition of the EMU, the European Monetary Union, because of the crisis in the banks in Italy above all, which always looks to Germany for a bailout, not on the cards this time. Very serious crisis there. And in the smaller banks, the lender banks in Germany, quite apart from the whole business with the Deutsche Bank, which seems to be resolved. But that is what we're saying, that Europe is facing such big questions and issues that relations with Trump, almost, provided he doesn't start World War III, and I'm not being facetious there, and relations with Britain are very, very low down the agenda.
Nina, just before we move on, very briefly, Merkel, I think you said that she's the almost looks like a last bastion of, you know, centrist common sense. Is she that, or does she just appear that way to our sort of desperate eyes at this time?
No, I think she is in the conventional understanding of the word, because if you actually look at what's happening across the Western world, you see a splintering of the center ground, either to the far left or to the far right. And this is a phenomenon I think that we're going to continue seeing in the year that's coming ahead. So Merkel is very much still going to be the centrist and strongest leader in Europe.
She is fascinating in the story of European and leaders of longevity, people like Thatcher, people like Tony Blair. Can I put it as crudely that, politically speaking anyway, she hasn't gone mad. And they usually do after 6 or 7 years in office. She is so steady. She is so calculated. Look at the way she has a very difficult hand. Look at the way she plays Putin. Mind you, it does help that they can speak to each other in each other's language. And that is why she is absolutely the linchpin. And she's still there and she's still strong.
Indeed. Just before the end of the show, we'll end with a story of resilience, professionalism and pure speed, because we're an optimistic bunch here at Midori House. The world's talking about Japan today. A giant sinkhole appeared in Fukuoka in the southwest, 30 metres wide, 15 metres deep. Authorities moved fast to sort it out. They fixed it within a week, a feat of efficiency that much of the world, definitely us here in London, would have been pretty, astounded by. We thought we'd ask what sectors or industries could take a leaf out of for Cuoco's book. You can't just put Brexit in. You can't put US democracy in, Robert. What needs a shot of Japanese efficiency to sort it out?
The bureaucracy of the National Health Service, and then it will be perfectly fine. It is one of the most egregious, if I could use that wonderful word, along with the, you know, one of the great bureaucracies, Indian State Railways, the bureaucracy of the People's Liberation Army. It really needs can-doism to do this. What the Japanese showed is that it's no use having a risk aversion culture. You just got to just do it.
Nina, we have about a minute left.
I'm going to go on a completely different tangent here, and I'm going to say it's one of those things that once you see it, you can't unsee it, and everybody who's lived in the UK knows about this, but the taps in the United Kingdom, one hot, one cold, mixer taps. We need a shot of Japanese efficiency so we don't either scald our hands or freeze. I think those need to be sorted out.
And that's probably doable, isn't it?
Apparently a German has invented a mixer tap attachment that you can just plug
there
into
you go.
Them.
So even the longest journey starts with the smallest step. A little bit of philosophy for you to end. Nina Schick and Robert Fox, thank you both very much indeed for being with us on Midori House here today. That's all we have time for on the programme. It was produced by Tom Hall. Research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Daphne Karnazes and Jake Fitzsimons. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. My thanks to them all. More music next. 1900 Section D with Josh Fennett is on the way. And we'll have more on all the main news stories of the day and one or two of the smaller ones as well on the Monocle Daily, 2200 London time. This show's back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for tuning in. Goodbye.